There's now been 5 weeks of fighting on the Philippine island of Mindanao. It's not completely clear the army's winning. In the latest development, pro-Daesh or IS militants reportedly stormed a school 200 k's south of Marawi under siege for weeks, though apparently a lot of the children were released after negotiation. And the Filipino president, Rodrigo Duterte, has been worrying out loud about a spread into civil war, speculating he was prepared to bomb the town of Marawi at the centre of it all to obliterate the rebels and a lot else besides. It reminds you of the conversations around that terrible war in Chechnya, doesn't it, earlier this century. It's making our whole region very nervous. And my guest, Joseph Chinyong Lau, says it's time for Southeast Asian nations to change their approach, to work more closely together and to intervene in the Philippines and anywhere else Islamist terrorism appears. But he cautions that an older network, Jamaa Islamiyah, might end up more of a worry than IS. Professor Lau is Dean of Comparative and International Politics at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Welcome, Joseph.
Hi.
Are you surprised there's been no end to the fighting in Mindanao?
It is quite unfortunate, although indeed I can't say that it is a surprise. I think this is a problem that has bedeviled the Philippine government for some time now, for many years, in fact. And it does raise a number of questions as to the ability of the Philippine security establishment, security forces, to handle this problem and to manage this problem on their own. But after all, it has become really a transnational issue, especially
which
with
you,
regard
and which you say means there has to be a transnational response, ideally.
Yes, logically speaking, and I think strategically speaking as well. I mean, we know that there are Indonesians there, there are Malaysians there, and these militants have been active in the southern Philippines for many years already. So there is every reason for the regional states to enhance their efforts at further cooperation to deal with this problem.
And this is very unsettling for your country, Singapore, isn't it, and your neighbours?
Oh, yes, of course. Like I said, there are a number of militants from Indonesia, from Malaysia, from Singapore as well, a handful from Singapore, who are known to be active in the southern Philippines. I think the porous nature of the border between southern Philippines and Borneo, for example, makes it very easy for militants to really take advantage of long-established networks and people movement channels to get from various parts of archipelagic Southeast Asia to the southern Philippines. And the southern Philippines at this point in time, as we know, is a really quite ungoverned space.
You know? Yes.
And I think that is the problem, isn't it?
But you did warn in a very interesting evidence to the Congress last year, who were inviting discussion about the Southeast Asia, to not to panic, I suppose I'd say. I wonder if you've changed your mind in the light of what's happening in Mindanao.
Well, first, I do still believe that we should not panic about this issue. We need to approach it in a level-headed fashion, in a strategic fashion, and in a collaborative fashion. Now, there is no denying that there is a threat of ISIS, Daesh, ISIL influence in Southeast Asia. And the networks that support ISIS in Southeast Asia have made it very clear that they want to establish some kind of ISIS-linked province in Southeast Asia. I mean, these are real challenges that the region faces. But we also need to bear in mind that terrorism, number one, is not new in Southeast Asia. We've seen various iterations and it morphs. It continues to morph. So in that sense, what we see with regards to these pro-ISIS elements are just, if I may, a latest sort of expression of a more deep-rooted problem that the region faces.
And what would you say it asks of the various leaders in the region? What's been the tenor of the conversation thus far?
I think it has to be approached in a number of ways, right? First, it has to be approached nationally, that is to say internally, I suppose, in the various countries, because there are various reasons why militants are sort of joining the bandwagon, this pro-ISIS bandwagon, right? Indonesians, Malaysians, Filipinos, Singaporeans, from what research tells us, they are motivated to join pro-ISIS networks for various reasons. Bear in mind, in the case of groups like the Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines, not too long ago, a decade ago, they were swearing allegiance to Al-Qaeda, remember?
Mm.
We know that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are at odds with each other. So Abu Sayyaf has very conveniently shifted from a pro-Al-Qaeda to a pro-ISIS position, right? So that speaks not just
to... So they're
to,
a campaign in search of an organization sort of thing.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, there are ideologues in there, but there are also opportunists in there. But on the other hand, we also know that in the case of Malaysia, some Malaysians who have joined these pro-ISIS networks are very ideological, you know, and very, very uncompromising in terms of their understanding and their adherence to the ISIS ideology. So the point is that, you know, we need to look at the various national contexts. But over and above that, I think, as I mentioned earlier, it is also a transnational problem. So we need to look at it regionally as well.
Are you really imagining some form of transnational force, like Singaporeans going in, or and with or without Australian help, by the way? I see we're going to supply two Orion aircraft, apparently, who are going to assist the Philippine Air Force. So that's something. But are you imagining ground troops here?
Okay, a number of things. Number one, there is already cooperation in place, right? There's been intelligence sharing that has taken place for some time already, even predating the current problems. There are now joint patrols. I think that all this is good, but obviously more can be done. I think that a dialogue has to be initiated with regards to deepening cooperation and looking at the possibility of joint operations as well. As I said earlier, yes, there might be issues of sovereignty as far as the Philippines.
Which has been a big aspect of ASEAN, that each nation was a sovereign state and that you respected the independence of its neighbours.
Yeah, indeed. But if you turn the problem around, if I was Manila, right, if I was the government in Manila, I have come to realize that there are Indonesian militants operating on my soil, you know, and that, to my mind, is a perfectly legitimate reason to enlist Indonesian help to deal with Indonesian militants that are operating on my soil, you know. So I think, given the changing nature of this particular security challenge, I think the mental frameworks of the decision makers may have to be adjusted as well.
Yes, I heard Sydney Jones speaking on our sister program, Late Night Live, the very respected analyst from Indonesia, suggesting that the Indonesian military was positioning itself to have greater control of counterterrorism rather than the police. And of course, Australia has had great success working with the Indonesian police force in the wake of the Bali bombings. So that would be a very significant shift, I think. Do you read it in the same way?
Oh, yes, indeed. It will be a significant shift. It will have pros and cons. I mean, to really understand the possible implications of this, we need to think not just in terms of the specific counterterrorism efforts that we are concerned about, but in the larger scheme of things, you know, the whole issue of the relationship between the Indonesian police and the military with regards to national security has always been a very sensitive issue, has always been a matter of considerable debate, not just among scholars, but really even among the political leadership as well. So we need to bear in mind all these other aspects.
Yes, indeed. And look, so many aspects of this. As we go to air, it's the last day of Ramadan. And through the month of fasting, there have been reports of, you know, significant reports of IS leaders inviting their followers to commit acts of atrocity anywhere in the world, I think, in the name of Allah, which is a complete travesty, isn't it, of what Ramadan is supposed to mean to followers of Islam?
Yes, of course, indeed. It is, as far as I see it, it is a massive affront to the religion and its followers. And it just goes to show how deep-seated a lot of these problems are. And a lot of it also derived not just from reasons of, you know, interpretation of religious texts or even of the religion itself. We need to consider also the kinds of social, political, economic, cultural conditions that influence, that motivate, and that also manifest themselves in these sorts of problems.
You know, well, like can I just interrupt because you part of your very strong evidence to the Americans last year was the urgent need to get into the prison systems, particularly in Indonesia, where you said there was a lot of active recruiting underway by both Jamaah Islamiyah, who of course Australians will know very well, and IS. And you presented that as a real clear and present danger.
Yeah, indeed. Not just Indonesia, but the Philippines as well. I think basically you're looking at very weak legal systems and very weak prison incarceration systems, where in the case of Indonesia, I think one of the biggest problems is the access that militant ideologues have in prison, the access they have to Gen Pop, as they call it, right? And that's where a lot of the recruitment takes place. And also the lack of funding that the prison system has means that it is all that much more difficult for them to manage this problem, you know, for wardens to handle the problems, to get the necessary resources, the necessary staffing, etc.
Food for thought. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Joseph Chin-Long-Yao. I really appreciate your thoughts.
My pleasure.
Professor Lau is Dean of Comparative and International Politics at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore.